This is an Enterprise Times podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm talking with Tony Tam.
I'm Tony from the Smart Bears Swagger team. I'm responsible for the open source Swagger project, as well as Swagger Hubs, which is Smart Bears' commercial SaaS offering. I created the Swagger project back in 2010.
What is Swagger?
That's a question that's asked quite a bit. A lot of people, when they think of Swagger, they think of it as a user interface around APIs. What is really at its core is a way to describe APIs. And we've been there before. I'm old enough to have worked with Corba and SOAP and Waddle, Wisdle. But what Swagger is a simple way to describe APIs, specifically REST-like APIs. But the idea is create a machine-readable description of the API, make it descriptive enough that it's usable, and then build tooling around it that can read it, display it, generate clients, servers, test cases, and that sort of thing. So think of it as a modern IDL, if you would, for REST APIs.
If you're going to make the code machine readable, we hear a lot about automated code, speeding things up. Is there a plan where people will just simply start to describe their applications and it will go and look at the metadata and begin to pull in pieces of APIs, which the developer will then tune?
I think that we're partway there even now with Swagger Hub. The structure that we have is descriptive enough to say how you consume an API. Then it's descriptive enough to say how you produce an API. And we can actually generate server code that goes very far, such that the developer's job is simply to implement business logic, which is fascinating because now all the plumbing that comes in from when an API is hit from a client to when it goes to the value-added business logic is completely boilerplate and automated, right? Which brings up some pretty interesting cases for microservices, also for security, high-speed development, and that sort of thing.
You said you work with SOAP. We look at the history of web services and other attempts to automate code, make code faster, componentize everything. One of the challenges we've had consistently has been the quality of that code. If we're going to start looking at systems automatically building themselves, for want of a better phrase, we have to improve that quality, improve that accuracy. Are you seeing a great move from developers to pay more attention to the quality of their code, the way it's constructed, the way it's documented, the way the metadata is created? Or are we still struggling with the same old thing we've struggled with for 30 years?
When you talk about automated code, some of the older attempts to auto-generate things like servers was really hard, simply because the scope of the problem that they were trying to cover was very large. The ability to generate good code got really hard, and therefore there were a small number of projects that could do it well, and across an even smaller number of languages, and therefore it became hard for there to be traction to take on those description formats and say that this is our source of truth. I believe that with Swagger, which is now the Swagger description language, or description format, which is now the OpenAPI specification, we've chosen a smaller set of a problem to solve, which has made it a tractable process for generating code. And because of that, developers have been able to produce templates and generated code logic that is reasonable and therefore less prone to errors and less prone to bugs, and which means that they can worry more about what those applications are actually doing instead of the ins and outs of plumbing.
A lot of this, really, if we go back to the mid-1980s, was described when we first talked about object-oriented languages. People had these grand visions that we would have fewer developers and more people just clipping things together. It's only the last couple of years where we've really pushed forward with the idea of composable environments. In terms of the elements then that go into this, the APIs, the microservices, are you seeing a move towards small pieces of code that are easily maintained, easily understood, easily used, or are we still seeing larger pieces of code and people not quite sure what should be in, what shouldn't be out, what constitutes the right size, for example?
That's a great question. I see people with newer, more progressive companies moving towards a smaller code and smaller microservices and even a function as a service or FaaS products, which is the smallest unit. If you think of microservices, the next frontier would be functions as a service. Larger companies that move slower, they're still trying to figure it out. And one of the problems is, in my opinion, that there's a great cost in refactoring to change the size of the software deployment. Meaning you might have a giant service that's been running for 10 years that somebody says, hey, wouldn't it be great if we broke this into microservices? But the task of doing so is so onerous that it's almost impossible to change. or somebody made a design decision to split it up an app into microservices, and it was a poor choice, and there's a great cost in reorienting that topology of microservices. Maybe they're too fine, maybe they're too coarse, or whatever. And that's where I think that the design of the services and how they interact should help facilitate that build-out, rather than the opposite, where I've built it out, and now that's my design, and it's very expensive to change. So I'd like us to get to the point where we can iterate on the design of the microservices. The deployment will follow in a very easy and iterative fashion, rather than just kind of being locked in to a particular setup forever because we made a bad choice.
Enterprises are being exhorted to take all the code they have in-house, turn it into APIs, not just make it available for their own developers, but then start to push that code outside. First of all, for business partners where they can control the interaction, but more importantly, beyond that, to make that publicly available. The idea being that it enables third parties to come in, write new types of applications, particularly mobile apps, and leverage what they have. But many organizations don't necessarily know what that code does at the moment. What challenges are you seeing for companies when they're starting to build their own APIs, and then where do they go when they start to make that third party usable?
Yeah, there's a couple of things that pop up. Big companies, when they say, turn our monolith into a microservice, sometimes they don't know where to start. And often what I've seen is the big companies will say, okay, well, let's just take our data model and let's describe it in our APIs, and let's then build out our API description and send our data model over. Not knowing that the whole data model from persistence is very different than what you might want to send over a REST API. For example, there might be obvious things like social security numbers and things that shouldn't be in. There might be nested information, internal types of data. So there's security aspects to the data that goes over the API. That's a big issue, and I think a lot of people don't really know how to separate those two concerns. What goes over an interface versus what goes into a database. They really shouldn't be the same thing. Likewise, if you just stick a REST interface in front of a bunch of code, you're going to end up exposing a lot of things that you might not want to. Functions that are internal only, that are not rate limited, that are not safe for DOS attacks, that are exposing data that they shouldn't be, that sort of thing. So it's not something that someone should take lightly. Just saying, let's just take our logic and set it up over a REST API and make it available for our customers to hit.
Part of the problem for these companies in turning these APIs and making them publicly available is time. They're being told they need to do it now, and going too fast is always going to be the enemy of security and quality code. Where do they get the skills from? Where do they get the tools from, first of all, to scan through what they're trying to turn into an API? And secondly, when they've got those tools, how do we get the education into the market so that people can use them and they can begin to improve where they are?
I have a pretty biased opinion around this, so bear with me. I don't think that starting with a bunch of code and saying, how am I going to make this public, is a good idea. I think the best thing is to say, well, what do they need it for? What do they need these APIs for? And let's design that interface. And we might not be able to build out what exactly we've designed, but we can think about it and say, this is for a payment system. This is the kind of information that they're going to need. This is what they're going to get back. So we design the interface in complete ignorance of what we've built. You spend the time seeing how you're going to secure it, how it's going to be accessed, how you're going to rate limit it, are there partner APIs that they have special visibility to, that sort of thing. And then build some kind of a logical mapping between that and what you have in the software component state. Right? That makes it so that you can have a clear separation when you go to build out between what would be a gateway, or you can call it many different things, a transformation layer, and how it talks to potentially a very big monolithic set of software. You don't necessarily need to split that giant monolith into 100 microservices tomorrow before you can expose it to a REST service. If you can build that interface, build the mappings to it, it'll help you understand exactly how that service operates, and it will probably guide you better in how to build out into microservices, as opposed to saying, well, we've got it like this, and boy, it's going to be hard to take that out, so let's lump these things together, right? Once you think about the implementation of your existing service, you start becoming very biased on what you're going to put out as far as the design goes.
Code housekeeping has come on a long way over the last decade alone. Companies are beginning to realize they have to maintain, they have to put the time and effort in. As they start to move towards APIs, in your experience, are you seeing companies putting the right processes in place so that these public sections of code are actually given a higher maintenance priority, that more attention is paid to what's going on to ensure that actually what we're exposing is not only safe for people to come into our organization and access systems, but also safe on their side of the fence?
I've seen a lot of things. I mean, the things that I've seen that work well are people within a company, teams within a company that are responsible for that plumbing layer, that's between the REST API and the business logic. And that has got, you know, the appropriate auditing trails, security checks, DOS attacks, like IP whitelisting, blacklisting, all that sort of thing. And they isolate the developers from that. The developers who work on the business logic are usually not the ones who are the best at dealing with network level security. And so that isolation allows then the developers to work on that particular business logic. I've seen that work out really well. It is a mindset, though, to take that person and say, look, you no longer need to worry about the API tier. You implement the business logic, and this other team is going to worry about that API tier. And then they can focus, that team can get really good at both the performance of that layer, the security of that layer, and the maintenance of it. And then you can evolve them independently. I've seen it work out. I've also seen where it's the same group going top to bottom, and you know, usually that ends in some kind of compromise, whether it's in the performance or security or what the actual application does, which is both of those are a problem.
Software development has never been a profit center inside organizations, not unless you're a software house and that's your entire product. For most enterprises, it's a cost center. With APIs, they're being persuaded that actually now they can move towards a profit center by opening these APIs up. But to do that, to put in place the people who are going to secure the APIs, the people who are going to do the maintenance, they've got to take on additional costs, costs that they wouldn't do for internal developers. Are you seeing a maturity in the market where people understand that, or are they still all just excited about the idea and haven't started to look at the long game?
I think that they're certainly excited about it, and there's a lot of people trying, which is a good thing, because there could be some new models that come out of it. There's a small number of players that do really well monetizing their APIs. I wouldn't think it would be a good idea in general for a company to say, yeah, we got all this engineering time, let's just put an API in front of it and charge money, right? There needs to be a real plan in front of it. And I've seen some really good talks around this. John Musser put out a really great talk about how you build a business model around your API. And there's a number of very well-known steps for who is it for, how do you monetize it, different aspects. Providing a good developer experience is essential for any monetizing of an API, and that's not free. And some people call the developer evangelists the new unicorns of the software world, and that's hard to get. So you can't just say, we're going to use an API management system that's going to let us charge for it, and we're just going to get rich.
If you're an IBM or a Google or an Apple or a Microsoft, you understand how to productize something. If you're an enterprise and you're in the IT department, monetization and productization aren't really things that you've thought about. Is there a need for companies to actually go and look at their whole business model and say, okay, there's a team over there who actually know how to sell what it is we produce at the end of the day, be that pieces of steel, cars, whatever. How do we take their skills on building, marketing, and creating products and bring that into the IT department to enable them to better create APIs for consumption?
I think that those are the people who build the thing that you sell and that you monetize, and that how it's monetized might not be the natural skill set for those people. It might be, we know from product usage inside our system that people want to do facial recognition on their photos. That could be a driver, for example, in an API for doing generic facial recognition, in which case that could turn into a real profit. I think of them as like the music makers, that they can help figure out the product ideas, and usually there's a developer evangelist or someone else that works with them to turn that into something that people can use, the right shape of the API, the right usage of it. I do believe in separation of concerns, and hopefully that makes sense.
So far we've talked about creation of APIs as opposed to consumption, and consumption is a much bigger issue. Understanding where the APIs come from, understand which version of the API we're using, having a mechanism to know when an API has changed or there's been a security change to an API. What we're seeing is we're seeing a lot of people building applications that are pulling in not just one or two or three APIs, but they're faced with this huge smorgasbord of APIs, and they really get quite slap happy about what they can pull in and what they can use. Do we need to do better developer education on, there might be a lot of APIs out there, but do you really need to use them?
There certainly creates a new levels of distributed failure when you bring in lots of APIs. I almost made a hypermedia joke. I could have said, well, that solves all of our versioning problems. But if you've seen anything that I've talked about in the past, you would know that that's not really my belief. I think it's a challenge. When you talk about how in the 80s to 90s, object-oriented programming was the solution to everything, and you're just going to take a library to do this and a library to do that, you're just going to jam them all together, and now the programmer just waves a wand and calls these things and magic happens. So that didn't work. I mean, it does in many cases. There are a lot of things that developers used to have to do all on their own, and now they don't have to. But that same attitude is coming to APIs. And there's a lot of challenges with it. Incompatibility. So I think of APIs as adding a whole other dimension of dependency management problems, including network-related ones. I do believe that when you start depending on remote services through APIs, there's a whole other level of durability and programming that you have to actually handle in your code. You don't want an outage on Twitter to take out your entire system. And I've seen this happen. I've seen the developers not take the time to understand the ramifications of putting, for example, a synchronous call into Twitter through the rest of their application. It's introduced a new consumption problem where developers need to be smarter about how you make these calls. You need to be aware when the APIs change. How do you update your code really quickly? If my mobile app is calling these services directly and one of them changes their API, it's a very bad experience if it breaks all of the copies of my mobile app until I push a new version. Aggregating calls to APIs on your own is usually a better idea than putting on your consumers. But I still think that the industry in general has not figured out a consistent, reliable, and easy to follow way to notify developers about upcoming changes. And some people just make changes and say, oops, wow, but look how much better it is. Well, you've got somebody whose livelihood depends on that API working. You just renamed a field and now everything broke. And so there's a challenge in that. It's not really clear. There's no registry of all API definitions. Now, tools like Swagger help make that possible. We can say, here is the contract. You say that this is the contract to the API, and here's the version. And then the consumer knows that you're at least putting down in writing somewhere what the calls are, instead of scanning some documentation that could change at any moment. Now, I think someday somebody will create a pretty comprehensive registry with change control, and maybe there will be a process that people follow to notify. But right now, it's a little bit of the Wild West.
I'm glad you mentioned the word dependency earlier, because one of the challenges here is when people are just pulling these things together and composing these new apps as they're being told they can do, they don't see the dependency links between them. And part of that is because they don't actually architect these applications. So there's whole steps that traditionally we would have done and understood that are now being overseen. Perhaps this becomes an operations thing, where the operations team run an application over the code, and it shows them where the dependencies are, particularly those APIs are pointing to internal systems or to external points, where firewall ports need to be open, or we have to have these degrees of access. Are we mature enough yet as a market to start to see those tools appear? Or are we still looking at the market and saying, yeah, we've got a problem, but it's been there for a long time, we just still don't quite know how we're going to solve that?
I think that the problem is certainly well arrived. Whether it's microservices for a small company, microservices for a big company, or a mix of microservices and external services, I think the solutions are the same. There are tools that are appearing that want to own all the traffic, and everything goes through it. And you know then what are the dependencies in your microservice applications. I know that I'm calling out to Twitter. I know I'm calling this other service, right? You know the traffic, the shape, and that sort of thing. There are tools that are trying to make their case for being put in as the gatekeeper of all the internal traffic. I don't think that that's the right solution. I believe in a distributed solution being better than one single gatekeeper, but it is a solution, and it's a way to understand what goes out, what comes in, and that sort of thing, and also to know how frequently that's happening, error rates that are happening, and if there's an outage. Right? I say, we know that our gatekeeper here, that all of our service traffic goes through, is always calling Twitter 15 times a second, but now it's getting 503 errors. I know I'm picking on Twitter, but it's the first thing that's coming to mind. I think that the problem is certainly understood. The way that it's going to get solved is not. The gatekeeper, like the single point where everything goes through, it's easy to develop and manage, but that's not really the best solution for a real giant organization. I was at a Google talk the other day. They said that every second they get a billion API calls inside. Inside. That doesn't count any outside ones. That's a lot of calls, and you're not going to route a billion calls a second through a single appliance or a single piece of software. It has to be some kind of distributed thing.
One of the things that we said when we started with SOAP and web services was if you didn't like the web service, the market was going to develop and you could simply junk it and drop another one in there, providing you understood what the input and output was. We're seeing a lot of the same language and statements being made around APIs. Are we really sophisticated enough as developers to say, oh, well, I don't like the way that company does it anymore and I'm just going to switch this in and out, my code will recompile quickly and my users will never know? Or is that just a great marketing thing?
I think that it's like trying to get two developers to agree on anything from different companies. It's almost impossible. There are API management companies, a couple names come to mind, that try to normalize the interface so that you can say if my connections to Braintree are not working, I can switch to Stripe.
That
sounds great, and the CEO might say, oh, right on, we're not dependent on Braintree anymore. But all your accounts are in Braintree. Like, what are you going to just one day switch it? So even if the interfaces are the same, there have been attempts to do this sort of thing, even to make similar interfaces as AWS so you can switch. You're not going to just switch. The problem is data, and once data is there, even if they're binary compatible, if the interface is the same, the security is the same, your accounts aren't there, and all this sort of stuff can't really happen. So I don't think that'll happen for probably forever. It sounds great, but it's so impractical. It's like just saying one day I'm going to switch from an iPhone to an Android phone, and everything is the same, except the data.
We've kind of danced around the big elephant in the room of this, and that's security. When an API goes bad or an API has a problem. The notification you mentioned earlier, we don't get told very quickly when something's gone wrong. If we're working with a vendor, then they will give us a set of bug fixes on a monthly basis or an emergency patch. When somebody's starting to use hundreds of APIs inside their organization and they're all external, they don't have the ability today to really know which APIs. They don't see the granularity of changes to those APIs because the API vendors don't necessarily notify that forward. Is this a problem that's just storing up and is going to become a nightmare later? Or is this about going back to good code hygiene and doing that testing of the API, doing that validation, and then internally saying, these are approved APIs, these are ones we know nothing about, and if you use them, you have to build a process to keep control of them?
It is an elephant, and the problem is that security is hard. The other problem is that developers, myself included, are lazy, right? And I say the best developers are really lazy because they automate their way around repetitive tasks. If you look at how most companies choose a service provider, they're going to choose what's the easiest to get started with, followed by the lowest cost, followed by some other criteria. Maybe there's some name associated with it or whatever. Typically, what they're not doing is looking into their track record on how many times, if ever, there have been breaches of security or outages or that sort of thing. If you accept the fact that people do what's easiest and laziest, that doesn't put the highest quality from the security point of view as one of the top picks. This is for smaller companies. Now, big companies are different. Smaller companies, like what are probably running the apps on our phones right now. That means that we're kind of at the mercy because we're using these services through another provider. So maybe I write an app and it's using something else to pass personal data to another service. I'm at the mercy of what they've chosen for security. And when that thing has a problem, I have a problem. I think that we have a big problem with security, and I don't think that there's enough attention paid to it. When you go watch a demo, the first thing they'd say is not, look how secure this is. They say, look at this feature. Look what it does. And you ooh and ah over it, instead of them saying, oh, this has got encryption on the chip. That's not really the selling point right now. So if the speed is feature, if that's what people care about, then people are going to do what's fastest, and that's usually not what's most secure. I think that good security, it's sort of hard, but not super hard now. There's libraries that help you with signing requests and middleware for ensuring that they're signed and open source to put the source code in the eyes of thousands of people who can say, that's a bug, you can fix this. So I think that it's not hard if it's paid attention to enough, but it's not the focus. It's not what gets you the award from your boss. The more and more breaches we have, I mean, look how much money Yahoo lost. Astounding amount of money, like $300 million on their sale price went down because of a security breach. I think people need to pay more attention to that sort of thing. Because for every Yahoo that has a security breach, I mean, there's got to be 10,000 other companies that have one. Making that something that people are aware of, making it clear how there's best practices to prevent that sort of thing as much as possible, and making scanning tools available for open source projects, I think is a good idea. And then maybe people will start taking it a little more seriously. But right now, I think it's kind of a mess.
We've got connected cars coming up. We've got car manufacturers who are going to have to open their systems. They're going to have to learn how to create APIs, how to manage APIs. They're going to have to create tiers of APIs as they bring in different people who are touching different systems. Do you see an opportunity for automotive to actually sit down, get rid of its past history of breaches and problems that it's had so far, but actually become almost a shining light in how to deal with a complex multi-tier API-driven environment where you've got so many people consuming them, but all of those people could be a threat?
Great question. I've been working with a couple of different automotive manufacturers on their APIs. We all love Tesla. If you look at the level of security that they have in their car, how they've separated the driving controls from the network point of view, from the comfort controls, that sort of thing. It's really remarkable. And read an article about how hard it was to hack one of those cars. There's an example of a closed system. They control absolutely everything, with the exception of a REST API to turn on the lights and stuff like that. What they haven't done yet is allowed third-party apps. And at some point, they will. I mean, I think they'll have to. People are going to demand that sort of thing. Once that happens, then they are in a position where I think they can really help guide the security of running applications, controlling the network access, securing between the app and the car, from the app and the outside world, and that sort of thing. Until then, it's a lot easier to have this walled-off system. The whole connected car thing is exciting and terrifying. There are some great hacks on Nissan Leafs where you can turn on your neighbor's Leaf's air conditioning and burn up the battery overnight, so they come to either a cold car or a dead car. Those are fun. It's not going to be fun when somebody turns off the brake. I'm hoping that, I'm not for big government, but I hope that the government is involved in some level of regulation on security against automotive apps, automotive systems, and I'm hoping that that comes back into, quote, traditional software instead of living off on an island in automotive world. Because there's going to be some fantastic security engineers and architects working on those, because people die if they fail. And whenever that happens, there's enough attention.
A couple of months ago, ENISA, one of the European agencies, actually published a very interesting document about connected cars saying exactly that. It gave tiers of liability. It explained what they need to do if you're a large automotive supplier who's got to have third parties involved, because they won't allow them to go back to a closed system. And it gave them a structure by which they can start to do things. So I think we're seeing the regulators actually getting their head around that.
The automotive grade Linux as well, like, they're following that structure and different levels and different access levels of components in the car, sensors and that sort of thing, and how they get back into the bus. And it's very complicated. It's a microservice environment. It's not much different, but people die when it doesn't work. That's the problem.
Well, let's hope not too many.
People could die. How's that? Yeah.
Thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much, Ian.